Hey there, everyone. You're listening to Eat Your Arts and Vegetables, your arts talk radio show on CKUW 95.9 FM here in Winnipeg, Treaty 1 Territory, Manitoba.
That's right.
I'm Zoe LeBrun, and with me today...
We have got co-host Eric Breckner, and we have one guest today, Zoe. We have Mathis Gerensky. Mathis has currently got an exhibition up at the 226 Main Street space. Him and Bramwell Enan have an exhibition up that you and I just saw just recently. It's a really impressive show.
Mm-hmm.
The exhibition is up between January 29th, so it's been up for a little while. You know, it's opening up tomorrow night, and it's going to be up until February 11th. So we have Mathis Gerensky here today. Hi, Mathis.
Hi. Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yes, thank you so much for joining us today. Why don't we start with hearing a bit about yourself and the work in the show?
Okay, yeah. So this is a body of new work that I've been making over the last couple months. And one of the defining features of it is that it uses something called a pen plotter, which is a sort of a computer-controlled drawing robot to make drawings. But all the work is physical materials. It's paper and pen, and there's something I like about that combination of materials and computational process that I find interesting.
And just to add, you made the plotter.
Yeah. I've made actually a couple plotters over the last couple of years, and there's something I gain from making the tools myself that I feel gives me more control, but also sometimes less control, which is important for me, making work, giving up some of the control and making mistakes and figuring out how things work.
And so you'd say like there's like you're bringing chance into the process. And
there's definitely some chance there, yeah. And actually some of the work explicitly uses chance. There are three small prints or drawings, depending on how you look at them, that use the process of dropping drops of ink from a high distance so that they create nice splatters on the paper.
Right.
So I've been thinking about chance and randomness, and that's definitely something that comes into a lot of computational work that's screen-based. A lot of people start working with random programming tools,
mm-hmm.
But it's nice to also work that into physical media.
Totally. And it's also interesting to see like work that is, because when I think about computer or coding based work, it's so precise, and if you don't have it exactly right, it just won't work.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is a really interesting show to kind of see how an artist can utilize these materials, but then still challenge some of the, I guess, like stereotypes about that kind of work.
For sure. Yeah. That's a good point. I'm glad you brought up, because one of the things that's really important to me about working on paper in the way that I've done with the machines that I've made is that there's no preview window or a way of looking at what the work will be before it gets printed. And so there are many mistakes and errors and slips, but they get sort of monumentalized or recorded in the object itself, where when you're working on a computer, it's easy to just throw away all the bits that you, all the mistakes that you make,
mm-hmm.
And you're left with this perfect finished product without any of that evidence of process. And so I think part of what I'm trying to get at with these physical materials is recording the process of trial and error, or developing the systems that end up making the piece.
For sure. And especially the larger prints that you have, like when I first saw them, I almost thought they were screen prints because of like the layering and the delicate lines that are really running through all of the pieces. And then you have some really interesting subject matter within them. It's like semi-abstract, and then there's like small recognizable things like writing here or like different shapes there. Can you talk a bit about the subject matter of the drawings themselves?
Yeah, it's another interesting point because it's a bit of a departure for me. All of the work in that you're talking about is derived from photographs that I've taken. So the data, if you want to think about it in that way, are photos taken with my phone, just little snapshots of things. Some of them are very close-up shots of materials or other drawings that I've made, little sketches in my sketchbook, and others are wider, more landscape kind of images. But yeah, like you say, they're kind of abstracted by the process of printing or the process of drawing.
Yeah.
And it's maybe worth noting that these drawings are made with a ballpoint pen, a very, very fine tip. And from a distance, it's you can't actually see that line. And so the lines kind of converge together and make this larger image that is does have a lot of visual similarity to either screen painting or lithography, I kind of think.
Yeah, they have a really interesting atmospheric quality to them.
Yeah, like when I first saw them, I thought they looked very similar to like serigraphs or screen prints, I thought. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. But then going up close, you can see the actual, like it's literally made with thousands of lines and colored lines. And so you can see the lineage or the line drawing created by the pen. And it's pretty interesting.
Yeah, it's something that I've always been interested in. I know very little about printmaking. I've never been a printmaker, really.
Yeah.
And I do really like the quality of that kind of image. But it's worth noting that these ones are, if anything, like could be thought of as monoprints, because they never get printed the same way twice.
Yeah.
Even though the computer is maybe giving the same instructions many times over,
mm-hmm.
The material conditions of the process prevent it from actually being a literal copy going from one to another.
Like, that's right. Like we were talking at the gallery today and you mentioned that, you know, gravity starts to play a part and, you know, so you're literally buying these pens and then connecting it to the machine you've made to do the drawing and you've said inevitably like gravity starts to come becomes a part of the process.
Yeah, and I've actually had to think a lot about center of gravity and where the resistance is from the pen to try and balance out the print head that I'm using. The plotter that I made for these particular drawings is called a pendulum plotter, and it uses two strings, essentially, or cables that suspend the print head. And so as it moves around, and it, in particular with these drawings, there's a lot of back and forth movement. And I noticed that this creates sort of a resonance in the machine, and sometimes there's these big standing waves that form in the cables, and it creates a lot of extra bumps in the drawing that are not to plan, at least from the computer's perspective.
Interesting. I like that.
I do too. I mean, for me, like it starts to feel like it's almost like you're bringing the human touch back into the machine or something.
Well, there's definitely something to be said about the maybe the mechanized gesture or the gesture of the machine.
Yeah.
There's actually every once in a while you see some work at a large art fair that is sort of using a machine in a kind of human way, making an arm, doing something else. I think I would say I'm peripherally interested in that. I'm more interested in the images that come out of it rather than the machines themselves.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, definitely there's some thinking about gesture there.
Mm-hmm. So what brought you to create your own plotters and what was that process like? Because I'm assuming you kind of just had to teach yourself how.
Yeah, I'm more or less entirely self-taught in that respect. It was actually a COVID thing. I was locked up in a room and I had an old inkjet printer with me that was broken. And I just took it apart and started investigating the bits and pieces. There were some sensors and some motors, and I just kind of wanted to make them do things. And so I made a very early prototype with pieces from this inkjet printer. And I've since moved on and sort of found other ways of using other found pieces to make these plotters. But they do sort of embody a sense of bricolage, of just kind of making use of what's available. And so I have lots of bits and pieces, and they often break and they have to be remade. And each iteration of the machine has its own different qualities and ways of making making lines.
For sure. Do you feel like all of these different versions of the machine are like anthropomorphized in some way, or like kind of human, take on like personalities?
Well, they do have a different gesture, but I tend not to, like, I don't name my machines. I don't personify them in that way, which is probably for the best, but...
yeah, because I guess, like, you know, if you change something, it just creates another iteration in terms of how that machine operates, and, you know, because mm-hmm. I guess 1 inch one way versus 1 inch another, and it, I guess, maybe changes how the machine will operate.
Especially with these wiggly line drawings. And if you come to the show, you'll be able to see what I mean.
Yeah.
The small wiggles really are a challenge to get perfect. Yeah. Not that I'm really aiming for a perfect print, but I really had to slow down the movement happening and fine tune the balance of the print head to make those things happen. So it's a really back and forth process. You change something and see if it works, go back. And sometimes that can happen even during the course of one print. Yeah. And so it's a very dynamic process, I would say.
And how long would you say it takes on average to make one drawing?
Again, it depends on what you're drawing and what's happening. So I did have to slow down my plotter for these drawings, and so they take a long time. I start a print maybe at 10 p.m. and then I come back, and it usually finishes around 10 a.m. Especially for the large ones.
Yeah.
But it's really amazing, you know, leaving something running for that long and coming back and being surprised by what's there. And for me, that really gets at this this sense of separating my like living self from the production of the work. I can give it some instructions. I sort of have control over that aspect of it. Mm. But then the actual work is taken out by a machine.
See, I feel like in that way, like it's kind of like printmaking, right? Like it's, you know, you're working on the stone or you're working on the plate or you're working on the screen. And then ultimately, you know, ink is passed through whatever printing process, and you never really know what you're going to get until you pull away that stencil or plate or whatever it is. And so I feel like it's similar with you in that you don't really know what you're going to get until that 10 hours or 12 hours is over. And that's where the surprises come in, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. And that leads me to think about another thing, aspect of some of these drawings is that they're kind of, presented in a raw state. There's little bits and pieces of the arrangement of the pen at the beginning of the mm-hmm. drawing that are left in.
Zoe noticed that mm-hmm. when we were at the gallery. Yeah,
and we were talking about how they kind of look a bit like signatures, or you know, they're the stamp of the machine. And they could be trimmed away. You could just leave the image that's there. But there's, I think, something interesting about
showing that
process.
Yeah, like all three of us thought, like when we saw them, we thought, no, I think they need to be there. You know, it's like,
it's also placed like perfectly in the center. So it looks like it should be there.
Right.
Like it looks just very intentional.
Yeah, like mm-hmm. it looks like a title or a signature, you know, like as you would in that sort of formatting for prints. And
yeah, so, it's kind of interesting because conventionally in computer graphics, the origin of the grid, which is what those little squiggles represent, is in the top left of the rectangle, mm-hmm. the top left of the screen. And so the grid increments positively to the right and down, which is kind of an inversion of the typical grid that you see in school. Yeah. But for whatever reason, I decided to put my origin in the bottom center. and it had to do with the way that I had to position the pen and then hang the paper. And that was kind of the easiest way to do it, to center the print on the paper. So there's always these aspects of what comes down to the process of setting things up and making it easy for myself that end up having a impact on the final image.
100%. Well, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Eat Your Arts and Vegetables, an arts talk radio show on CKUW 95.9 FM in Treaty 1 territory, Winnipeg, Manitoba. I'm Zoe LeBrun, and I'm with my co-host Derek Breckner and artist Mathis Grunsky. We're talking about Soft Paths, an exhibition that is up at 226 Main Street Gallery. Does that gallery have a name? Will it ever have a name? I don't know.
It just might be 226 Gallery.
It's just 226.
226 Main.
And everyone knows where it is.
Yeah, 226 Main.
It's right, like, by Modern Electric.
Yeah.
And times changed.
Yep. And the exhibition is up until February 11th. Do we have times in terms of when the space is open?
The space will be open Saturdays and Sundays from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. or by appointment. So if you want to drop by and you can't come during the weekend or for the opening, please get in contact with either myself or Bramwell Enan and we can arrange something.
Okay.
For sure. And so Bramwell isn't with us today, but I was wondering if you'd like to speak a little bit about his work that's in the gallery as well. There's a really interesting dynamic between your work where yours being completely kind of on paper has like that still 2D quality, and Bramwell's is very three-dimensional.
Very much so, yeah. I think where We used to share a studio space in a studio floor, and I would always pop my head into his space and take a look at his work. And there was something about the way that he was working with materials that I found interesting and similar to the way that I was working. At the time, I was working a lot with cast plaster and taking imprints of materials that I had around me. And Bram was also doing something very similar, using different processes and achieving different results, but sort of starting from a similar place. And so when the opportunity came up for this exhibition, I thought, I know, I want to have a show with Bram. I think that'd be really exciting. And it turns out that that was true. And so I'm really excited about looking at our work together. And there's some other connections that I didn't even foresee that end up coming out from just having the work up in a space together.
Yeah, like I was noticing, like with the paintings that, or the, one of the few paintings that you did, the color in those paintings seemed to reference some of the color that Bram was using, and that was something that you guys hadn't planned.
Yeah, there's some nice burnt oranges and greens and purples that kind of permeate the show, and I think it's come together in a really nice way, chromatically.
Yeah, it's a really stunning show.
Yeah, I mean, you're a person that hangs a lot of work, and so you know when a show is hung well, right?
Like, it's good. Yeah,
it's hung well. You know, it's like it's.
Yeah, you might have seen. I had my face against the wall, trying to see behind the prints, see how they were hung.
It's a secret.
Oh, well, that's a story in itself. That's a
is
yeah.
It?
Oh, yeah. That's
oh.
A great,
yeah. Yeah.
That's
how much do you want to know?
All of it.
Well, so it's always a challenge to present work on paper, especially large work.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
One of the conventions is to use nails and magnets, like a strong magnet on the front of the paper. And I've always felt that that was a little distracting to me. It kind of competes with the work a little bit. And so for these ones, I didn't have the capacity to frame them. They're fairly large pieces of paper, and there's quite a few of them. And so what I ended up doing was cutting a piece of what looks like a frame stock. So it's kind of 1x2 dimension inches. And just cutting a small slit down the middle, sticking the paper into it, and then wedging little shims behind the paper to keep it in place.
Okay.
No adhesive. No adhesive.
That's pretty awesome.
So we'll see how we do with the humidity. I'm hoping they're not going to fall out.
Yeah. Yeah. Are you worried about any creasing of the paper? Or?
There's a little bit of waving that happens. They are pinched in that way. So when they grow and shrink as paper does when it gets
moist.
Yeah.
Humidity.
Yeah. That will happen, but that's just, you know, working with materials.
And work ages just like the rest of us do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's very interesting, because I was trying to see, like, is it, like, hinged with tape or what is going on here? But no, little shims. That's very interesting.
Yeah. We forgot to show that when you got there, but he pulled one off and showed me from the back, and we forgot to show.
Okay, you got the insider.
I got the insider, but yeah, I was quite impressed with that. You know, but this is the thing that I find interesting about Mathis, is that, you know, in some ways he's a sculptor, you know, like, like it's about, you know, he's making drawing machines and he's making the things that he's using to hang the work. And I don't know if I've ever seen a hanging system like that. Have you?
Okay. I'm not sure. I've definitely seen like a clamp situation for posters.
Yeah.
That
then dangle.
Then it holds, but it's really tight, and it usually ends up creasing and damaging it all along the top.
Yeah, where that's not going to be the case.
It doesn't sound like it.
Hopefully not. Yeah, the paper is in a flat state, so it doesn't actually get bent at all. I mean, we'll see. We'll see. It's an experiment, so...
100%.
I'm willing to experiment on my own work. So,
so, just out of curiosity, do you ever like record like as the machine is drawing, or have you done recordings
in terms of audio or video? I keep records for myself.
Yeah, but there's not any place we can see them, is there?
If you dig deep on my Instagram, you might be able to find something. But I tend to shy away from showing studio shots. I don't know if I can pin my finger on why, but.
You like the process to be in the work, not in the documentation.
I think that's one way of putting it.
Yeah.
Also, as soon as you put something up on the internet, it's there forever. And I always want the ability to control what's there, because I don't know. It feels good to keep that limited in some way. So I take a lot of photos in the studio, but I don't post them on Instagram.
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, it's interesting, especially, you know, since the rise of AI and, like, how different artists are approaching sharing their work. Some people are now only posting, like, wide views of their work in the studio so that an AI can't go and take directly from, or maybe they could still, I don't know. And then, you know, you're kind of going the opposite direction where there's, like, no version of the process scene.
Yeah. You know, I'm not, for myself, I'm not too concerned about that aspect of AI, as we're calling it, because I feel like AI can't truly do the thing. I think there's some conflation between the artwork itself and its documentation.
Yeah.
And so if an AI is learning from a photo that I took of a drawing that I made, it's only ever going to make a digital image that might look like that thing. And so I feel like it doesn't quite compete on the same level as making a physical object.
Yeah, definitely.
It does come into play with music and other things that live more seamlessly on the internet.
Yeah.
But for myself, I'm not too concerned.
Yeah, like, because I don't think the AI is going to capture, like, the imperfections of the process.
Yeah, exactly. Not, yeah. Yeah. It's worth noting that I don't use any AI in my work. It is programmed. It's written in either Python or JavaScript sometimes, but I don't use any machine learning algorithms in my work.
Yeah, hand coding.
Yeah.
Love it.
Impressive.
Mathis is the one that taught me how to code.
Oh, that did you take? Oh, that's right. You were in that thesis thesis course.
Yeah, we did some HTML and some CSS.
I've never been so frustrated in a class. But it worked out.
I'm glad it did.
Because you're now coding now, aren't you?
I code my own website, yeah.
There you go.
It's really important. I think especially a lot of people are now seeing how much control these large corporations have over your digital footprint. And so having the ability to represent yourself online, even in the capacity, like, you still have to be dependent on web hosts and things like that, but controlling the way in which your images are shown, I think is really important. Even if it's a very bare bones website, it's different from Instagram. It's different from Facebook. It's different from whatever else is there.
All the other templates.
Exactly. Right, yeah.
Yeah. 100%. There's nothing that bothers me more when, like, I once tried to make a website using, like, a pre-existing sort of template, and you open it up and it's all just like shop this, shop that. And I was like, I hate this. Yeah. I'm just going to stick to what I got. And it's better that way.
So we got maybe about 6-7 minutes left, Mathis. Any final words in terms of things that you would like to talk about? I mean, I would just like to have to hear, if you got a couple minutes, maybe we could just talk a little bit about, you know, your evolution of working with technology and your work. And it sounds to me, and I'm speculating here, but it sounds to me like there's always been this kind of combination of crossing between the handmade and the machine making in some ways, or
So when I was in school doing my undergrad, I mainly was interested in painting, and so for a long time
this is at NASCAD.
At NASCAD University in Halifax.
Yeah.
And so for a long time I considered myself to be a painter, and in a certain respect I still do.
Yeah.
But I always had trouble with the act of making the mark, of being responsible for that mark on the canvas or whatever gesture that would be. And I found myself gravitating more towards the found composition, the found object, or however you work that. And so the very first kind of computational work that I made was actually not using computers at all. I guess it wouldn't be computational, but maybe system-based would be a better term.
Right.
And so they were large paintings that were one-to-one scale reproductions of city sidewalks with the dots of chewing gum that had been spat on the sidewalk as the composition. And they were just black and white, and I was really interested in that kind of found experience that was there, and putting myself in the position of just moving something from one place to another, taking something that I found and positioning it into the gallery, a la Marcel Duchamp or, other artists of that ilk. And so for me, working with code kind of gets at that process of kind of compartmentalizing an idea and then positioning it into a drawing or something else like that.
Yeah.
And so it does take that sculptural feel sometimes, because it is really thinking about materials and thinking about looking at things in space, mm-hmm. but it often gets kind of flattened into an image or something like that.
So in terms of like the process of coding, when did you first code? Like when did that first start?
I started coding about maybe 6 or 7 years ago. I was working at Emily Carr University at the Studio for Extensive Aesthetics with Amber Frid Jimenez, who's a professor there. And her studio is really awesome, and I got kind of interested in code. But it was an interesting experience because I actually started coding thinking that I would make music with a computer. Mm. I wanted to code my own synthesizer at the time. And I couldn't see a possibility of making art, like visual art, with a computer until I learned the tools. And then all of a sudden I was like, oh, I see ways of making things that I didn't see before.
Yeah, the through line kind of appears.
Yeah, really one of those cases of having to have the tool to know what to do with it. Like not knowing what to do with the nail before you have the hammer.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. I like that a lot. Yeah. In some ways, it's like algorithmic at times instead of like computational, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't even know. I wouldn't even know how to begin to even say what's the difference between computational and algorithmic. It's pretty impressive comment. It's like,
I mean, yeah, it's a tough. Yeah. Jargon, I mean, parse.
But I'm sure there is a difference. I'm sure Zoe's right on the money here.
Core, what it comes down to is that there's a set of instructions,
right.
and whether it's done by a computer or by a person, the sort of underlying theme of the work is that there's a set of instructions that are taken out, and there's many artists that have used tools like this to make their work. Prior to computers, for instance, Solowit makes large wall drawings that are executed by artist assistants, not by himself.
Yeah, systems.
Even sort of the Fluxus artists and people like Yoko Ono putting together scripts and scores and things like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, listen, do you have a website that you can share with people?
I do have a website. It's my name, www.matisgrunsky.ca. And on it, you'll be able to find a link to this exhibition or information about this exhibition. It'll be up in the top left corner, the little cloud you can click on. It'll take you to a page with everything you need to know about this show.
And that's Matis with two T's, just for people typing it in. Yeah, so I guess maybe we'll wrap things up. But I want to thank you very much, Matis, for coming in and doing the interview with us. And
thank you for having me.
Oh, our pleasure.
Yeah. Thanks again for being here. Stay tuned for Tawny the Brave, everybody. We'll be back next week with a to-be-announced guest.
We're not sure yet, but we got a couple of things kind of batting in the air that we're kind of still figuring out, but we would like to bring that in. And just a reminder that Fun Drive is also coming up soon as well. So, do get your early pre-pledges in to start to support commercial-free radio here at CKOW 95.9 FM. And but we'll be back Thursday next week at 5:30. And just before we get Dave from Tawny the Brave on, just want to maybe just do a little plug here for something that's happening at the Human Rights Museum. There's an exhibition that's on that's called Love in a Dangerous Time, Canada's LGBT Purge. And this is an exhibition of stories of injustice and activists who fought to change. And the exhibition is formally opening up to the public tomorrow, the 31st, and it's going to run until 2026. And Shauna Dempsey and Lori Milan have a piece in it. And also Noam Gonick has got a piece in it too. And Freya Olson has choreographed something for Noam's work. And so, it's an interesting thing. I think it's a thing from the 1950s, 1990s, where the government of Canada systematically, created a lot of problems for the LGBTQ community. And this is kind of it's like a lot of things have come out of it, but there was a lawsuit that was won in 2018. And so, there's a lot of things in terms of the history of that we're going to be able to be educated about, I think, which is good.
Yeah. Well, do check that out when that opens up.
Yeah.
And, All right. have a good night, everybody.